Room 237. If Stanley Kubrick had wanted to make Room 237 in The Shining really scary, he would have filled it with film critics and conspiracy theory nuts arguing about the meaning of his film.
Room 237. This is a documentary about The Shining in which five different people have their own particular idiosyncratic take on exactly what this horror film by Stanley Kubrick adds up to and means. One of them thinks it involves Kubrick helping to fake the moon landing. Another one thinks it's a stand-in for the Holocaust. Another one thinks it's about the red man being wiped out.
Calamute.
And another one just has a vague idea about centaurs and stuff, which I never quite added up to anything ultimately for me. The reason I was interested in seeing this, because when I first saw The Shining, I was there opening night, and I remember after I had watched it, this was the feeling I had. Somebody had done an amazing job of duplicating Stanley Kubrick. We're talking about someone here, he's my favorite director. So I saw this film and it just felt like, well, yeah, they got the look right, they got the dolly shots right, they got it all right, but something at the core of the film was just missing and didn't work. The reason I bring that up is at least two or three of the people in this film, and most people, I think, in general, will admit initially they were disappointed with the film. And then after the fact, they came back around to a different understanding of film because it didn't work for them on that first viewing.
I'm somewhere in the middle. I'm a huge Kubrick devotee. I thought it was a strange combination, him and an outright horror project. So I was fascinated by it. And certainly the trailers of the blood coming out of the elevators really hooked me. I liked it, but I was left kind of empty, too. You know, of course, that's true of a lot of his films. It's a work of visual genius and it's worth seeing. So, you know, as great as Kubrick was and as much of a cult phenomenon as The Shining is, I don't think it carries the weight of all this speculation and study.
I always think it's fascinating to listen to film theorists bring their own slant to a film, Freudian or postmodern or feminist. I had a friend once who was going for her PhD in film at USC, and she would take apart these films in this odd sort of way. You see that angle? You see that little triangle of light down there? Well, that represents, you know, moo moo quack quack. And I would just kind of turn to her and say, Mary, maybe that just happened. And of course, she was so deep into study that she was like, no, nothing just happens. Well, what if the director didn't know about it? Well, he did subconsciously, or it's there because he chose it to be there. And so I kind of think that's sort of fun. That being said, you have a lot of that in this documentary, and almost too much. You talk about being left cold from the actual film. I was sort of left cold by this.
I guess the thing I find interesting about it is you kind of have a guy with a conspiracy theory, and then you also have kind of these egghead people who tear films apart from, you know, a critical studies kind of mindset. And I think they're both the same in that you have a lot of people who do conspiracy theories, and they don't like the idea that the world's just a mess sometimes and things just happen because they happened. For them, I think it's even more frightening that there's no grand plan behind everything by the Illuminati or something, pulling the strings and making things happen. The idea of a messy world where people just make stupid mistakes, they can't deal with it. And I think sometimes people in critical studies, for all of their supposed love of the creation of certain artists, they're actually afraid of the creative moment in that it's something they finally can't hook onto, they can't control. And because they can't, they sometimes create these armatures of reason and explanation that are almost completely separate from the actual work itself.
And a little daffy.
Yeah, and a little daffy. So I think both of those people get there because they reverse engineer the movie, but they never take the real creative process into account when they do that. I mean, that said, I don't mind people having their own interpretations of a piece of art. I think part of what happens is you bring something to it and sometimes it brings something to you. But when you say that's what Kubrick intended, that's a different thing. Because I like the ideas Kubrick helping NASA to fake the moon landing. It's completely goofy off the wall thing. But when you insist that that's what's going on in The Shining, I have a hard time going there with you.
Well, I mean, just the whole thing with the Calamute baking powder and American Indians, there's just part of me that wants to say yes, or that's a pretty cool look logo on the Calumet baking powdered can, and it makes for a good background.
This one guy's whole interpretation of it was almost that it's all about the white men wiping out the red men, and to a great extent, this is based on the can in the background in two shots.
Yes.
You know, that's pretty thin stuff. I always feel that films like The Shining and even something like Vertigo, they're these unsuccessful films with big empty territory in them. You know, it's like the Oklahoma land rush for certain kind of critics, you know, because they can run in, they can stake out their claim and make whatever crazy thing, you know, they need to say, and it'll fit because the film itself isn't working. Or if you're like an auteurist, you have to get in there and start propping up the story and making excuses why it doesn't work on the fundamental level and saying, well, on all these other sub-levels, that's where the real message is. I don't think so.
Well, I'm reminded of Lolita, and my favorite inside joke in Lolita. I still know people who just are amazed when I point it out to them. Shelley Winters, of course, plays Dolores Hayes, the widow of Mr. Hayes. And when she points to his picture on her dresser, it's actually the Hayes of the Hayes Code.
Right.
It's such a delicious joke because this movie was, wow, can they make a movie out of Lolita? And it's Kubrick's sense of humor. Her name is spelled differently, but it's still Mr. Hayes. You know, Kubrick had a real sly sense of humor, and whatever's going on with the Calumet baking powder might just have been that as well, rather than this whole comment upon, you know, how we decimated the red man in America.
And it's not like filmmakers don't have certain themes that recur in their films. I mean, if you want to take something, it's like, take the bathroom scene. There's the bathroom scene in Lolita. He's in the tub and all that. There is the bathroom scene in Dr. Strangelove where he goes to commit suicide. There's the zero gravity scene in 2001. There's a bathroom scene in A Clockwork Orange. And if you want to get into it, the king of the bathroom scenes for Kubrick is The Shining.
Spartacus.
Yes. But so,
oh, Spartacus. That's right.
Yeah. So, you know, if you want to take something that's actually in film to film to film and then come up with some kind of reason to explain it, that's fine. Because the other kind of research these guys never do, let's take Mr. On the Moon guy. If he could have just said something like, and you know, for a period of from blank date to blank date, Kubrick's presence couldn't be accounted for, or we knew he was in America at a certain time during the... I mean, if there was just some kind of physical evidence or even a comment from a person who's something like, well, I don't know where Stanley was for that day during the moon landing, I would go, okay, maybe we're on it. But it's all based on the film, and it's all this super conjecture that just... It's so weird. Little Miss Minotaur lady, she talks about the maze that they all play in. Originally in the book, it's a topiary garden, and these kind of vegetation animals actually come to life. Kubrick wanted to do that, but in the early 80s, he said, I just don't feel that the special effects are at a state where I could do it convincingly. A little more research, you know, will explain a lot of things. The one Indian guy saying is, all the blood pouring out of the elevator, which I have two things to say about. One is, the brother of a friend, when he saw the trailer, his reaction to the elevator scene was, my God, that's really scary. Can you imagine what the cleaning bill is going to be? Originally, my understanding was the elevator scene was shot specifically for the trailer, but either because it got such a good reaction, or even more likely, in my opinion, they saw how unscary their movie was, they decided to actually plug it into the film. So if this is your key defense of the blood of the red man coming up through the elevator shaft and out the door, it was never even intended to be in the damn movie.
If you do research... Your theories can get blown, and nobody wants their theory to get blown, and that was pretty apparent in this film.
Yeah. There's a few things that work against my enjoyment of the film itself, but I'm not a big Kubrick fan, not a big Duvall fan. I thought the kid was horribly miscast.
Thank you. I never liked the kid.
The kid was just horribly miscast. I hate documentaries. they just are all over the place. You know, you're supposed to... I don't even know what these guys look for. They look for a guy carrying a rug up a stairs in the background.
That sounds ridiculous. Like, maybe he's being vague, but no, there's a lot of talk about the guy carrying the rug and showing up with the rug, and I never really was clear on the rug guy.
And let me tell you where they lost me. The hotel boss gets up and shakes Jack Nicholson's hand. He's like, see, he's got a hard on. Look at that.
He's behind a desk. He gets up to shake hands. There's like a...
Like an inbox
There's like a two-level inbox, and on the top inbox, there's like a red folder or something, so that when he stands parallel to the folder, it looks like that red folder, if you wanted to interpret that way, could be a hard on, which, and as we speak, I'm wondering why that even matters.
Now. I don't know.
What did that tie into? Even if it was true.
I'm supposed to invest any time in this film?
That's who you feel sorry for. They must have seen this movie like 50 times, you know, just watching it over and over and over again just to come up with nonsense.
And there are certain things that happen in every movie. It's like, there's a chair missing in this next scene.
Oh, no,
so there's a sticker that's not on the door. It's like, what? It happens in every movie.
Steve makes a great point. No, because there are times where they go, this sticker of Dopey being there or not being on the door means something. And in the background, a chair being there in one shot, and then we cut away to Duvall, and then we come back to Jack, and the chair's not there. And that's some kind of comic comment on horror films that's so tenuous. But as they tried to make all these points, like Steve's pointing out, I kept thinking, you know, this is a much sloppier film than I had realized. That's, I started to lose respect for him as his filmmaker. So I just thought, my God, he must have been really uninterested, just one continuity failure after another.
So the continuity girl wasn't writing things down. It's like, okay, so what?
Stan finally looked over and said, honey, I'm mailing this one in. It's not working. Don't worry about it.
And then this really wasn't filmed as a documentary because they use scenes from old movies to kind of fill in for the guys who were talking. You know, here's Jose Rodriguez, and Tom Cruise walks out and is like, oh, look at that. He's looking at a poster. It's like, so it's almost like a docudrama or something. The first guy who's the guy who figures out about the boner, and then that's bookended at the end by the Minotaur lady. It's like, oh my God.
Well, the Minotaur lady, in the background of one shot, kind of out of focus, is a guy skiing. And because he's skiing, he's bent down on his knees as he's coming down a hill. And she says, so that kind of looks like, you know, the legs
of a Minotaur.
Yeah, and it's like, no, not really, honey. Not really. You can go there if you want, but no, not really.
Here's what you need to do. Put this on a double bill with Salinger.
There you go.
Oh, God.
But the point is, this documentary is just not entertaining in any way. It bored me. And that's the thing. Something so concerned with criticism, they didn't realize that their own film was, you know, was failing the test because it was just failing to entertain or to grip or edify in any way.
I think what it's really missing is, because they decided to do five people, I think if they had only done two or three, the thing that makes these kind of people interesting is their obsessive kind of blinders, narrow vision. And because they split it up between five people, I mean, I know there's a lot more to like the moon landing guys take on stuff. So it's like, if you lose their obsession, you lose a big part of what's interesting about these films.
Yeah, if you make it too clinical with just like five people sitting around.
If you don't feel their passion, if you just see a lot of kooky ideas kind of disjointed. And I thought this was a very bad decision also. Instead of presenting one idea, one idea, one idea, they try to mix them all in and go back and forth between one idea and another idea. So they, by the time it's over, in terms of just being its own thing, a standalone documentary about something, it's just a mishmash that's just kind of, it finally falls apart.
Yeah, so as a documentary, in that case, it really fails.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if Kubrick was around, he'd go, what a bunch of crap.